Welcome back to 20 Minute Bio, and I'm your host, Aiden Lowe, back from the college application hiatus to bring you my favorite episode so far. It's an interview with my biology teacher and current homeroom, Mr. William Van Leeuwen. So, disclaimer, this interview was recorded back on August 26, 2021, which for me seemed like a lifetime ago, but it was just fascinating to hear the conversation that we had last summer vacation. And I found that as I was editing the audio earlier, that having gone through the college research process and thought about my future endeavors, I saw topics we discussed in a new light, and it made for a very enjoyable listen. So hopefully you enjoy this one, and I'll see you around. And today in the call with me is Mr. William Van Leeuwen. He is not only the head of the science department in Fuxing, but also an avid marine biologist, petologist, and simply a person with a zeal for life. Thank you for deciding to spend time with me, Mr. Van Leeuwen.
No, thanks for having me, Aiden.
First question is just, what is your career as a biologist like before you landed at Fuxing?
Well, I don't really think that I had a career in biology that, you know, most traditional people had, because, you know, I didn't really pursue my graduate degree in biology. Instead, you know, my graduate degree work is in education, right? So it's definitely less of a biologist and more of an educator in that sense. However, I did work in the scientific field. When I was an undergrad, I had two jobs where I worked in laboratories. I worked with Bill Sullivan at UC Santa Cruz in his genetics lab. But, you know, that was kind of a normal job. It was like you clock in, you clock out. You know, you have these tasks that you need to do, so you just do them. There's no real like critical thought going on. And if I'm honest, I think that really anybody can just be picked up off the street and just trained and just, they could do that job, right? I mean, it sounds very technical, like using an autoclave and sterilizing equipment. Okay, but it's really not that complicated. And so for me, it wasn't like really interesting. It was kind of cool because you had to, you know, wear safety equipment all the time. So you looked like you really knew what you were doing. You had to have like this access card in order to get into like top secret research areas.
Yes, so, I've been there.
Yeah. It's like the first 2 months, you know, it's glamorous. But after a while, you just kind of do the same thing over and over again, kind of helping the scientists prepare for their experiments, right? That's kind of what lab techs do. And then, you know, in that capacity, you just treat it like a job. You know, there's not really too much that they ask you to do in terms of critical thinking or actual science. So for me, that was that. Now, in terms of the science that I enjoyed a little bit more, this one I wasn't paid for, but I did work for NOAA. And it was more like an internship. And so I worked for the Mark Carr Ecology Lab at Santa Cruz. We have an adjacent facility next to the main campus called Long Marine Lab, right? Really cool lab. They've got a blue whale skeleton in the parking lot. And just the NOAA facilities right next to the marine lab are just fantastic. They're like state of the art. You can simulate seasons using artificial lights for your experiments. It's just really, really cool.
Damn, okay.
They have these like cool tanks that simulate river ecosystems too, because they, you know, they do study river fish. So they put the river fish in there and then they have them swimming around in a circle with a current so that it simulates constant movement. In any case, it was really cool. I got to actually, you know, record data. I was responsible for making sure that the experiment went well. I had to do some questionable things like euthanizing the fish that I was taking care of for 6 months.
Right? So that have bonds with those fish, like emotional bonds?
Well, I mean, there was definitely some sort of connection. I mean, I was there every single day taking care of them.
Yeah. Right?
So, you know, it was kind of sad to have to do that. But, you know, it was, I think, for the sake of science.
And for the sake of science. You know,
I'm still conflicted about it, but I think that's something that everybody probably should think about in education. You know, we sometimes glorify science, and I think there is a dark underbelly, and I think people should explore that. And you know, see where they personally draw the line. I think it's the same thing could be said for things like hunting and just eating meat. You know, how many people eat meat without realizing what goes into that process? Okay, and the same thing could be said for science.
Yeah, I generally agree. It's like, it's kind of like the first step is to have consciousness of what you're doing, and then you can make assessments. It's not like you're just blindingly following some guidelines or social norms.
Right.
Going back to marine biology, what sparked your interest in it in the first place? Was it always something you wanted to do before you attended like college?
Yeah, I think at first I was always interested in biology. You know, I loved my biology class in high school. But I think that really led me down the path of medicine, right? So I love dissections. Mm. I love physiology. I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah.
I just loved learning about the different parts that animals had. So I was kind of torn between like veterinarian science and also just medical science in general. So I started out in Santa Cruz with a bio degree aimed at pre-med. And then I shifted towards marine biology because I started taking all of these marine biology classes. It really clicked with me because at the time, you know, I was surfing almost every day. I was scuba diving. So I was spending a lot of time in the ocean with people who were in love with the ocean. And, you know, it's very infectious. You know, there's this whole group and they're just all like obsessed with the ocean. And, you know, that kind of gets at you too. And so I think there was a sort of a cultural aspect there too, a social aspect. Mm. But ultimately, I just started exploring all the different things that UC Santa Cruz offered in terms of marine biology. And it hooked me, right? Not just the culture, but also the people that work there, right? So like my scuba diving instructor, she made us work really hard. We had to do lots of cool rescue diving, like drills that just made me love diving. And it was very active and engaging. On top of that, you know, Monterey Bay is a marine sanctuary and it's got some extraordinary biodiversity, right? You can watch whales. There's like thresher sharks, kelp forests, right? A very, very thriving intertidal zone. So no commercial fishing allowed there. And then on top of that, you have these world-class scientists, marine biologists who have been all over the world and they're just inspiring teachers. Like maybe two of my favorite were my fish teacher, right? Giacomo Bernardi, my ichthyology professor that is, right? One of my favorite assignments that he gave us was to go to a fish market, pick up a giant fish skull, take it home, boil it so that it became all just the bones, right? So just boil away all the tissue except for the calcified tissue. And then take all of the bones and put it back together again. And it was just an amazing project. And I loved that project.
Very hands-on.
Yeah. And, you know, in that class, we dissected all sorts of different fish, like cartilaginous, bony fish as well. And then we ate it, you know, when we were done, right? So it was like environmentally conscious. It was a little bit weird.
Yeah,
but,
that
know,
was a little bit, it's a little reward after like all the things you have to go through.
And then, you know, I also loved my invertebrate zoology professor, you know, you know, he went down to Antarctica to do some research. He even has a beach named after him. His name is Baldo Marinovic, and I believe it's called Marinovic Beach.
Marinovic Beach. Yeah.
You know, just hearing those stories and seeing their passion and just kind of being there really hooks you into marine biology, I think. And, you know, no regrets. I didn't end up really doing marine biology outside of, you know, my work in the NOAA fisheries. But in the end, you know, I think it's a big part of my life still. So I still consider it worthwhile.
Yeah, I think that experience also shows that like what you're going into college doesn't necessarily, like the college can shape you. Like because it was so close to the sea and because you had all those resources. And I guess like marine biology is something tangible because everything is like microbiology. And of course you can look at it under a microscope, but like, I don't know, fish is just, and the ocean is always accessible and something you can like interact with. I think maybe that's the appeal.
Yeah, maybe, you know, I did interview a graduate student because I was in a science journalism class as well. So I had to go do, kind of like what you're doing right now, actually. And nice. one of the people I interviewed was just like depressed graduate student, right? And he just really didn't like what he was doing. And he was
what
studying,
did he major in?
I thought it was fascinating. He was doing like ocean chemistry, but he basically was with one of the scientists that pioneered the iron fertilization experiments from like the maybe 2 or 3 decades ago, right? The idea is you go to nutrient poor waters that would normally sustain massive amounts of phytoplankton, but because they're nutrient poor, that's the limiting sort of nutrient in photosynthesis there.
Okay.
So
okay,
they just
okay.
dump that nutrient into the ocean, causing massive eutrophication. So it causes the phytoplankton to bloom, and then therefore it's supposed to suck in carbon and you know, stop global warming. but in any case, he was studying these micronutrients that were in the water. And you know, it was like very intense lab work. And I think that he was just ultimately very unhappy. Maybe he went into like ocean science because of that sort of tangible, you know, love for the ocean. But in the end, he just ended up in a lab looking at, you know, numbers.
I see a lot of correlation with lab and depression. This sounds pretty, it's a warning, huh?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it takes a certain type of person to really want to do research. And it turns out that, you know, because as a culture and as a society, we glorify that. I think that people sometimes don't realize that it's taxing in different ways. I would say that if you're truly passionate about what you're studying, research is great. Okay. But if you're really looking for just something else in life and you just kind of stumble into it and just, you know, you let the current take you, I think you can probably end up a little bit unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Nice ocean analogy there. so speaking of transitioning, you decided to spend more time in education and eventually becoming a science teacher at Taiwan. So what kind of motivated you to do that?
Well, for me, I think Taiwan was just kind of an adventure mode. And I think you'll probably experience that once you finish college, right? Because you're going to just do college and then you're at this stage in your life where you're like, what's next? And a lot of people just transition seamlessly to their careers. But then, you know, they end up a little bit regretful as well, right? Because they didn't go out and explore. They didn't do things when they were young, right? They just started sinking their teeth into their career and just went that direction for the next 40 years. The next thing you know, they're 60 and retiring and like, wait, what? Wait, why did I do that? And, you know, it's okay, right? It's a choice that I think everybody needs to make. But for me, I really wanted to explore the world a little bit. So when I was in high school, I did an exchange program in China. I lived in Xi'an for about the better part of a year. And so in that time, I had this revelation about how much I love traveling and working. And so I definitely wanted to do that after university. So I still had my lab tech job for about a year after leaving Santa Cruz, because like I said, it was a job, right? It wasn't just an internship through the school.
Yeah.
And that was fine, but it was a little bit, you know, not that interesting. And so, you know, the allure of traveling and teaching came. And so I took the offer and I came to Taiwan to teach for 1 year. And I've been here ever since. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's probable that I'll go back to the U.S. and, you know, teach there for a little bit. But I also am looking forward to the future as well. And, you know, continuing my dreams of just going to different countries and teaching, right? So, you know, I'm very interested in going to Japan and teaching for a little while. And And I'm also interested in teaching in Europe. Like, I would love to try teaching in Scandinavia, right? Maybe learn something from their kind of, you know, the epitome of the educational system, so to speak, right? Just kind of learn from them. But yeah, so I guess I came to Taiwan really just for that sense of adventure. And I'd say that I kind of got stuck here because of of marriage, but it's not really, I don't think it's like getting stuck. I think it's just an extension of stay for just a little while at least. And, you know, I do feel like one day I might come back to Taiwan and just kind of retire here. It's a fantastic country.
That's lovely. You also mentioned that you think that science education is like severely lacking in the teachers that will actually do the job.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's what makes teaching science in international schools, you know, a viable career choice for people who really, you know, love science, love interacting with people, love education, but at the same time also love exploring new cultures, right? So I feel like there's a very specific mindset, a combination of interests that can make international school teaching a very viable option for people who are interested in that. And a big part of what makes it viable, especially for science teachers, is this fact that, you know, science in English is a very, it's a limited position in the sense that people really, really want to have you. And there aren't a lot of you there.
Okay, so, definitely.
Yeah. It's definitely something that holds back a lot of international schools, right? So they have plenty of, you know, English teachers, plenty of social studies teachers, but they're really lacking in science and math teachers. And I think that that's actually pretty true for a lot of the United States in general as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a sentiment that people sometimes have a negative impression of teachers, because they think that science is all about innovation and research. And if you're not going, if you're not studying and if you're not doing research in a college somewhere and just like teaching people, there's like, oh, you're just recycling knowledge or something like that. Yeah, but I mean, I do see the self-discovery kind of process within that and like kind of interacting with different cultures. And I mean, at the end, you are nurturing the next generation sort of. So I guess it's really valuable in that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, people can't just jump from elementary school to college, right? And then just start getting taught by professors, right? You have to have teachers at every step of that stage. And I think that valuing each one for their specific skill sets are quite important. Like I have tremendous respect for first grade because I've done all sorts of teaching and I've taught from third grade to senior high school. And, you know, I've tried first grade. And no,
it's chaotic, isn't it?
Ever again.
That's the most, actually I have the most respect for those, the teachers of those like levels, because how do you even tell them to sit down?
Just infinite patience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have to pull people over, and then I mean not pull people over, you have to pull these children like away from the crowd and then scold them one by one. Like yeah, I can't imagine.
Hopefully it's not just scolding, but definitely like having a solid understanding of, you know, early childhood psychology is really important because there are some things that developmentally, you know, these kids can't do at that age, right? Their brains just aren't really, you know, set up for that yet. You being aware of that, you know, you can really guide them, you know? So if you look at like psychological standards for each grade level, you can see, you know, what are the benchmarks that each child needs to hit, right? Like maybe this year they need to focus on sharing, right? That's a big, big thing. Okay, maybe another one is empathy, right? Like learning how to empathize with others. Okay, so these are like goals for early elementary that are really, really crucial, because if you see them missing in an adult, it's like, it's very obvious that this person is, you know, very hard to get along with, you know. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for that, and I wish society would as well.
Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of like I had a conversation 2 days ago about like a cognitive science student, and then he was talking about how it's actually like it's really weird that we're putting students like first graders and second graders in classroom and telling them to sit down when that's not the development stage that they are in. And like, yeah, he personally believes that we should use that time for like body awareness or like PE. He thinks that that should be emphasized more, and that kind of fits with the more like the psychological development stuff.
Yeah, and I think there are plenty of psychologists that would agree with him. And plenty of schools that sort of follow that philosophy as well, right? So, I mean, if you're a parent one day, Aiden, you just make sure you look at the school philosophy and see what you're into. Your school, unfortunately, this school that I currently teach at, does not really embrace that philosophy, right? Which is interesting, right? It makes me wonder what your parents' philosophy are, right? So everybody kind of has like a different sort of perspective on what should be done. And for some people, it's about the development of a child so that they become like a holistic, good human being with appreciation and discipline. Whereas for others, it's more like, you know, this is a harsh world. We need to get our child to be as realistic as possible in this competitive environment so that they are super, 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 super ready. And, you know, I think that that really just, it depends on the values of the parents and the educational community. So I think you'll find all sorts. There's not necessarily a wrong answer, but it's interesting to kind of analyze and look at.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely interesting. Your classes, specifically your biology classes, are regarded as the best in Fuxing. Personally, I believe that the emphasis on like group discussions, case studies, and essay writing make your class not only enjoyable, but practical. So I was wondering, as a teacher, how important are these elements for you in your own teaching?
Yeah, so I think for me, you know, like, and I've written these down, right? These are like the four fundamental rules, like, and then of course there are, you know, branches and, you know, concept maps that connect to other aspects of teaching, right? That we don't have to talk about. but for me, at least, you know, I think engagement and motivation is one of the like most fundamental aspects of, you know, getting kids to learn, right? Because, you know, I wrote down some other things too that I think are important, but honestly, we could just kind of forget about that right now, because engagement and motivation, I think, is honestly all you really need. If you can get all of the students interested and wanting to learn, right? So we call that, of course, intrinsic motivation, right? If you can get that to happen, then everything falls into place. You know, they respect you, so you don't have classroom management issues. They want to work hard, so you don't have like homework and you know, delinquencies or lateness or issues like that, or you don't have to worry too much about grades anymore or standardized tests, because people are just working hard to like learn these things, right? So I think that ultimately that passion, right, that motivation, that inspiration, is really important. And for something like science, I find that it's quite easy. Like, I don't know if I could do this for English, you know?
I don't know, I could do this for math or physics.
Yeah, but Mr. Calhoun seems to do it okay with English. So I think it proves that it's possible to really get people inspired and motivated. And once they are, you know, that learning just, it just naturally happens. And there are other things you can do to fine tune it, right? But that's, I think, the most important step. Okay. And for me, you know, discussions are great, because it gets people to argue. I think that's a huge part of learning, right? You're trying to like articulate your perspective, and then you hear other people's, and you have to like work it out. Okay, I think that's really good. I think case studies are good, because learning everything from the perspective of a narrative, from the perspective of a story, is always more interesting than a dry textbook. I think that, you know, when I think about my favorite science classes, I think about how much they had me doing as opposed to memorizing and listening.
Exactly.
And in the end, you know, that has had a very big impact on me, right? Because I know that I learn the best when I'm doing something, whether it's dissection. It didn't have to be dissection. We don't have to kill animals to be engaged, right? But, you know, for me, like in university, well, when I was in high school, I took some university classes in science. And one of the classes that was my favorite, which I really wish Fuxing could somehow have as well, is cosmology. And if you don't know this, cosmology is
yeah.
The universe, right? Some people mistake it for cosmetology, right? Which is, you know, cosmetics, right? Not the same, but cosmology is just, it's so fascinating. You know, the fact that the atoms that make up my body were synthesized during, you know, The explosions, the supernovas of stars, right? One of the most violent things that happens in the history of the universe, right? This concept that we're constantly being bombarded by cosmic rays without really being able to detect it from happening. This idea of the black hole and what exactly the heck that is, you know, all of this stuff is just amazing. And having a teacher kind of really help you with that and kind of expose the mysteries like that can really hook somebody into science. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I got into science, you know, just having those types of science teachers that made me marvel at life. And so if I can do that for my students, you know, get them to be just interested in wondering why things are, then I consider that to be, you know, the most important thing I can do.
Yeah.
By the way, to give you an example, I don't even consider myself the best. Like you, I think you said I was good, but you know, honestly, I think I could do a lot more. You know, like my favorite physics teachers, check this out, right? So he's trying to show that, you know, the larger the area that a force is being exerted on, the less, pressure you would feel from there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What he did to kind of demonstrate that was to put down a bed of nails, right? And then he said, if I were to step on this nail, right, then the nail would just go through my foot, right? Because the area there is quite small. But if I increase that area, which he did by laying down on the bed of nails, then all of a sudden he didn't feel any pain. And then to really demonstrate the point, he put another bed of nails on top of his body.
Yeah, I think I've seen the videos before.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. I mean, face value, yes.
Yeah, but like the next step was he put like a cinder block on top of that bed of nails. And then the final step is he had another professor come in with a sledgehammer and then just like slam down on the cinder block, like stone exploding everywhere, landing on students. And then he just gets up and says, and that's why area is important for
demonstration. That's, like, that's badass. Overkill, yeah, but badass. I think one of like kind of the key term is like interaction. I think like even just like going up and moving, like if it's like an English discussion or biology discussion that we had in your class, I like the first thing I think about is how like the table arrangements. We had to arrange tables to go in that small group. And that's what gets me excited. Okay, I'm talking to three people, randomly selected from the class, and we're just gonna work on this thing together. Like, instead of just everyone facing one way, and then it's like, oh no, what did he say? Because my grades are gonna crash if I don't remember what that person said. Yeah, I think that's like the motivation. And of course, the teacher has to be motivated as well, which actually is not a lot of teachers have that. So that's definitely like something I picked up from that.
Okay, well, yeah, I think those are very good observations. And, you know, I think for you, Aiden, you know, you're learning about how you like to learn. I think that's really important, right? That's that metacognition we always talk about, right? So, you know, as you learn how you better learn, then you can, you know, manipulate that and use that to your advantage when you go to university.
That'll do it for this episode. Tune in to the second half of the interview, uploaded in a few days, where Mr. Van Leeuwen and I talk about our most memorable diving trips, STEM major prospects, and what the future holds for his education career. See you then. Bye-bye.